Yes, okay. Somebody asked me a very good question last week, and I would like to elaborate a little more. The question was raised that if everything on the Sanhedrin, or on the Beis Din, those words are synonymous, by the way, Beis Din, Sanhedrin, we'll be using them synonymously. So if everyone requires witnesses, so the question was raised, how could you have a system of justice? Because if somebody's, I think the question was that somebody's ox went on my field, then how could I? I'd have to have two witnesses to set them up in order to catch him, and et cetera, et cetera. So it would be very difficult. There are a couple of points I'd like to make with regard to that. It's a very good question. The first point is that you have to realize that the court could do, as I said last time, court can make people swear, and we're talking here about a person, a society, where the Sanhedrin would enforce the law. So that would mean that all of the people in the society must keep the 613. So you couldn't have a situation where you have people that are open violators of the law. Nevertheless, you have to realize that the individual laws must be viewed in terms of the framework of the society. So that is one factor. Of course, nevertheless, a person could say, but you still could have people that are that sneak by and are crooked and lying, which is true. And then you have the fact that the Sanhedrin used to use certain things, certain measures, psychological measures, and certain they make them swear, various things, which are, an average person really, even though you think it's easy to do, it's not that easy to do, as I mentioned last week. But there's another answer as well, and that is that there are really two agencies that enforce the law in the Torah system. One agency is the court, the Beis Din, the court. There is another agency also, and that agency is the king. And that's why there is such a thing as a king in Israel. The purpose and the function of a king is to enforce the law, and the way the king would enforce the law would, strangely enough, not be according to the prescription of the Torah for the Sanhedrin or for the court. In other words, he could do what he could do without any witnesses. He simply went by his own knowledge, his own understanding. And the purpose of having these two systems is precisely because of the question that was raised, that the system of the Sanhedrin is not enough, really, because there still can be people that are lawless, that sneak by the system. And there, if you're going to insist on witnesses and testimony, and if it's going to be so strict as I was describing from the Mishnah the last time, then you're going to have a problem, because you're going to have people that are going to be able to evade the law. And that's why you have this other system, which is the system of the kingship. And the king operates functions according to his own mind, and he is not restricted. He has absolutely no restrictions in terms of how he judges. And this can be seen from a few places in the Tanakh. And here's where studying the Tanakh, not just reading the Bible, but studying the Bible, offers us some insight. Take a look at, for instance, Samuel 1:8-20. Now this is a case where the people of Israel ask Samuel for a king. And they said in 8:20, "Will we also be like the other nations?" But you see what their claim was. Their claim was, "And our king shall judge us, and he shall go out before us and wage our wars." So the function of the king was really two things. It was politically, in terms of waging wars, and it was also to institute justice. The justice of the king is different than the justice which is instituted by the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is restricted by the type of evidence that's acceptable, and it's extremely difficult, as I said. For instance, to kill someone is extremely difficult because of all the specifics and all the requirements. But then there's another system, the system of the king. Now, the king functions according to his knowledge and according to his intelligence. He doesn't have the restrictions. And his purpose is, wherever the Sanhedrin, wherever he sees the system is failing, and he needs to move in order to bridge that gap, then he that is his function. Now, if you take a look, for instance, in the in Kings 1, you find the same thing. You find that that when Solomon was appointed king, so then it states in Kings 1:3-5, it says, "In Gibeon, God appeared to Solomon in a dream of the night, and God said to him, 'Ask, what shall I give you?'" And then Solomon starts off with, as we said, he has the formula of praise first, and he starts off with the praise in verse 6. And then he says, and then he places his request in verse 9. He says, "You should give to your servant a heart that listens, understands how to judge your nation, to have understanding between good and evil. Because who can judge this great nation, this honorable nation?" So you see that the request there was for judging. So you see again from the Tanakh that the function of the king is to judge, and that is because the Sanhedrin is not enough, because the Sanhedrin has all these halachic restrictions and requirements. So at first, of course, the system tries to operate by the Sanhedrin alone, if that would be the ideal society, where you don't have to have the king intervene. But in the event that that's not enough, and many times that is not enough, then the king has to instill justice. Now, it's very interesting, but if you take a look at that same paragraph where King Solomon asks for the knowledge to judge, and take a look at that famous story you have there. It says, right after he woke up, in verse 15, "And Solomon woke up, and behold, it was a dream. And he went to Jerusalem, and he stood before the ark of God, and he brought sacrifices, and he made a great party for his servant." But then the very next verse is the beginning of that famous story. It says, "Then two women who were harlots, prostitutes, came to the king, and they stood before him. And one said, 'Please, my master,'" and you know, the same story with the one child, and the two people claiming this one child. Okay, now why do you think? What do you see from this? This is an amazing thing. If you just look into, here's where you see how the Torah offers amazing insight, just casually, but you have to be observant. Now, what's interesting about this is the fact that the Torah immediately places this judgment as the first judgment that it mentions, you know, about the king. Now, what's strange about this judgment is, who are these two women? These two women just come off the street, which is amazing, and they're of the lowest class of people, and they come and they stand before this great king, King Solomon, the greatest of all kings. Why? How is such a thing possible? What do you see from this? You see from this an amazing thing, and that is that this, the king, no matter how great he is, there must always be access to him from even the lowest echelons of society, even the lowest level. The king is not permitted to make himself important by not allowing anyone to have free access to him. Anyone and everyone can go before the king. Of course, the king couldn't stand all day judging all the people. King Solomon must have had hours, you know, when he did this. But this was done on a constant basis, and it was probably on the basis of first come, first serve. You cannot have a king who is removed from his people or who refuses to see even the most simple individual. That's the principle of Torah. And that's why the Torah has this story right after it tells us that the that King Solomon was given this knowledge, that he asked for this knowledge, and God promised to grant him this knowledge. So it shows you, it gives you the case, and the first case that it gives you is a case of that you would imagine would never even be able to take place. Because after all, if a man is a great king, he's not going to just allow anybody to walk in. But no, the way of Torah is that everyone must have free access to the greatest person in the society, the king. There is no one too great that can remove himself from the people. That's an ethic of Torah. we see again, so you see again this this concept that the king is the judge. Not only is he the judge on big matters, which of course he spent most of his time doing, but he also must allow a certain part of the day must be set aside where anyone can come before him, and he judges according to his wisdom. That's the famous story where with splitting the baby, he judged according to his wisdom. He did not need any witnesses. He just used his knowledge and his intelligence, and that is part of the system of Torah. And you have the same thing in Isaiah, when Isaiah speaks about the King Messiah. He also mentions that that he will in Isaiah 11:4, and he will judge with righteousness the poor, and etc. That verse goes on to explain how he's the greatest judge. So the greatest human judge is the King Messiah. So that's the same concept. So you have these two systems working hand in hand in Israel, in the system of Israel. One is the Sanhedrin, which works halachically. That's the halachic system. You must have witnesses. They must be. You must put them through the greatest scrutiny, separate them, cross-examine them, re-examine to see if everything fits. Anything is wrong, the testimony is completely discarded. And all these very specific laws and restrictions which the Sanhedrin must abide by. But then that is the preferable, that's the preferred kind of justice that the Torah looks for. But then you must have also a system of ordinary justice, because the society itself can't exist with the perfect halachic justice, the perfect halachic justice alone. So this is a very, very interesting concept. I find it interesting for another reason, because here I find also the fact that that you have the concept that that the person is equated to, like, the individual is equated to the state, in a sense, because you say a person is like a small world, and what this means is we find with regard to the individual. You have the same kind of a system. The individual has two systems. One system the individual has is the halachic system to perfect himself. And there he must use all the halachic means that the Torah gives man. And he must be very strict and abide by the letter of the law, just like the Sanhedrin had to abide by the letter of the law. Because every detail that the Torah gives is given by God, and it's perfected. Then on the other hand, the individual has to guide his life philosophically, his direction. There he must be like a king with regard to his own life. So you see, an individual here is equated to the state, where the individual has two systems and the state also has two systems. They both have a halachic, legalistic, specific, very specific, formal type of system which God gave him. And then they also have the system of free reign of the mind, where the mind has to use its own wisdom and its own knowledge and its own intelligence. There's no halacha that tells a person what should he do at this point. Should a person direct his energies towards doing this type of activity which will perfect mankind, or another kind, or should he perfect himself, or should he spend more time studying? What should he do? How should his day best be planned in order for him to accomplish the most? What is the most expedient manner in which he could make use of his energies? In that type of a situation, the halacha doesn't help. You have to have the person has to use his own individual mind. So you see, man individual runs by two systems, and man collectively operates by two systems as well. Okay, so that covers that area. And now I'd like to go back to the Talmud that we were discussing, the tractate of Sanhedrin. All right? Now, we finished the Mishnah, if you remember. And now we are approaching the Talmud. Okay, now you have to listen to the... I'll give you the translation of the text of the Talmud, of course. And what you have to do is listen to it slowly, you know what I mean? Let it sink in, and then we will see how we have to analyze it. And as I keep on emphasizing, the main thing is to learn the method of analysis, okay? All right, let's take the first piece of Talmud. Now, we remember the Mishnah was discussing a person who blasphemes the Creator and the formula for it. Okay, and here's where the Talmud starts off, and the Talmud states at first, the Talmud states that the we learned, which means this is a fact of the oral law, that a person when he blasphemes, if he curses the Creator, he has to use the Creator's name twice. He must use the Creator's name as the initiator of the curse, and then the Creator has to be the object of the curse. Okay? Now, that is the fact that the Talmud states. It's a fact which is part of the oral law. No one contests this fact. Okay. Now, the Talmud says, now the Talmud raises the question, how do we know this? What is the source for this? Okay, so you'll tell me, well, the source is the oral law. That's correct. But you must remember that the oral law cannot come out of nowhere. The oral law always must have roots in the written law. That's a principle of Torah. You cannot just have an oral law just floating around without any basis. Except in a case of a, what we call a law to Moses from Sinai, and maybe one time I'll go into that, what that is. That's an exception, though. That's an exception to the rule. That's the only time we have a law of the Torah that has no basis, no roots in the Torah in itself. But otherwise, every other law always has to have some type of source, an allusion to the oral law in the written law itself. So the Talmud raises the question. Talmud says, now, where do we know this from? What is the source for this? That when the person blasphemes, he must use the Creator as the one who, you must say, Yossi, again, I'm going to use the word Yossi, that Yossi should destroy, Yossi should harm, Yossi should curse Yossi. And the word Yossi we're using in lieu of the Creator, because we're not allowed to enunciate such a thing. Okay, so the Talmud raises the question, where do we see this from? How do we know that this is so? Okay. Now, I'm going to raise a question on the Talmudic question. My question is this, that whenever a person curses, as I one time mentioned before, a curse is only a curse if a person uses the name of the Creator, okay? In other words, that's why I mentioned that I told my students, you should not say, God damn it, because if a person would say to another individual, God damn you, that's a curse, and it's a violation of the Torah. So it's a bad habit to get into. But whenever a person curses, in order to violate the law of cursing, you must use God, the Creator, in your curse. If you don't use God, if a person just says, damn you, that's not considered a curse, according to Allah. That's just, he's angry. It's just the expression of anger. But a curse must have God's name. So my question is this, that why does the Talmud ask, how do we know that the Creator must be used here, the name of the Creator, we're going to use the word Yossi. Yossi should destroy Yossi. The Talmud asks, how do we know this? If I were there, I would say very simply how we know this, because by definition it has to be that way. Since a curse always has to have God as the one who is doing the harmful deed, and over here he is cursing the Creator himself, the only logical possibility is that the person should say, Yossi should destroy Yossi. Okay? That's the only way that it's logically capable, that logically one is capable of expressing the formulating a curse of the Creator, since by definition curse always means the Creator is the source. So my question on the Talmud itself is, what is the Talmud's problem? Why does the Talmud have to raise this? What kind of a question is this to begin with? The source, it would seem, is very simple, because since this is a curse, and every curse has to be initiated by the Creator, so over here you're going to have to use the Creator twice. Once as the source, and second as the object. Okay. That's my question. All right? Now, let us just leave that question, keep that question in the back of our minds, and let's just forget about it, pocket it for a while. Let's just go back to the Talmud, okay? Now, the Talmud states like this. Talmud raised the question again, how do you know that you have to have this formula, you know, Yossi should destroy Yossi? And the Talmud says, well, it can be derived from a verse in Leviticus 24.
In the Leviticus.
Because in Leviticus 24, where after that incident, where that individual did this committed blasphemy, so the Bible says, so Moses didn't know what to do with him. So Moses said, placed his request before God, and God said that that this man is deserving of death. Okay. Now the Torah, after that, the Torah universalizes. Moses received the law, and the Torah tells you the general principle, and that is in Leviticus 24. 15. It says that, and to the children of Israel shall speak, saying, any person who curses his God shall carry his sin. And then it goes on in verse 16. And he who blasphemes the name of God shall be put to death. The entire congregation shall stone him. And then it states the stranger and the sojourner, When they curse the name, they shall be put to death. Okay? Okay. Now, okay. So now, this is the verse which is the general principle. If you'd ask me which of the entire chapter, where is the verse that states halachically, gives you the formula, that is the verse. It is not the previous verses, it's verse 16. Okay? And the Talmud states that when you look at this verse, when you analyze this verse, the Talmud says you will see from here that he has to use the name of the Creator, both as the one who is the initiator of the curse and also the one who is the recipient of the curse. Why? Because it says the beginning of the verse says he who curses, who blasphemes God, should be put to death. And then there was no reason to add the last part of the sentence. It should have just stated, he who blasphemes God shall be put to death, the entire congregation shall stone him, this is so for the proselyte and for the one who is the and for the one who is the citizen of the land. There's no reason to add those last three words at the end in Hebrew, that when they curse the name, they shall be put to death. Okay? There's no reason to add that at the end. It was unnecessary, extra. So, therefore, the Talmud says that with that extra shows you that he must use God's name twice. He must use the God's name in terms of the being the source of the curse and also the recipient of the curse. Okay, now when you hear this, when you read this, if a person would be reading a translation of Talmud into English, so the person like would say, well, this sounds kind of arbitrary. I mean, it could be that there are extra words here, but how does this show that that you must use the name of God as being the one that does the harmful deed, the one that does the harmful deed to Yossi? To you understand? How do you derive this from the fact that there are these three extra words? Sounds like the men of the Talmud were just being very arbitrary here. That's true. It does sound like that to a person who doesn't understand what the underlying principles are. But what I want to show you is that when you do understand what the underlying principles are, it makes perfect sense. Now, what I want to do, though, before we answer this question, too, so we have two questions now, is just to go a little bit further. And then we will come back and answer three questions, as a matter of fact. Okay? So you have to have, again, you have to have a little bit of intellectual tolerance here. Let's just leave these two questions now and go a little further. Now the Talmud goes further, continues and says like this. It says, how do we know that this word, in other words, this is the verse. The verse, if you, the Talmud, of course, the oral law, zeroes in always on the halachic, substance of the Torah. And the halachic statement over here is 24:16, as we mentioned. Now the Talmud says, let's take that halachic, let's take that statement of the Torah. The Torah says, he who blasphemes, who curses God, shall be put to death. But in Hebrew, the word is nokev. All right? So the Talmud says, how do we know that that word nokev means to curse? All right? So the Talmud says, because there is another verse in Numbers where Balaam says, how can I curse that which God didn't curse? So you see that, and it says the exact same word, no cave. Over there, it's echo, but the same exact root. So the Talmud says, you see, there's no other way to explain that other verse. From that verse, from the situation of Balaam, it's quite clear that his purpose was to curse the people of Israel, and that's why he said, how can I curse it? He used that word over there. So we see that word means to curse. All right? So the Talmud says, well, that would seem to settle the question, but the Talmud says there's another meaning for that same word. And that word, and the other meaning for that word, is to drill a hole, strangely enough. Because in Kings 2:12, you have that word no cave, and it's not just in Kings 2, it's used in Hebrew very commonly also. As a matter of fact, it's used more and more commonly, that word no cave means to make a hole in something, like to drill a hole. So the Talmud immediately raised the question. Talmud says, okay, so we know, that's how we know that that it could mean to curse, but we still haven't proven it because there's another meaning for that word. That verb also means to drill a hole into something. So the Talmud says, and now how do we know that this verse which says, he who curses God, maybe it doesn't mean curse. Maybe it means the other possibility. Now, how would it be, what would it mean, the other possibility? The other possibility would mean as follows. That if you took the name of God and you wrote it, let's say you wrote it on a, piece of wood, on a ballot, you wrote it on a little piece of wood, and then you drill a hole in it. You take a drill and you drill a hole in the name of God. Maybe that's what it means. And the Talmud says, as a matter of fact, that that's precisely what we do by idolatry. When it says that one should wipe out idolatry in Deuteronomy, it says you should wipe out their name, and that means that you should destroy all the names of the idolaters that you find on their on their religious objects. And then it says, and you shall not do so unto God your God. And that's where the Talmud derives the fact that you're not permitted to erase any one of the names of God. So if a person writes the name of God, you're not permitted to erase it. So the Talmud says, so maybe that's what it means. He who drills a hole in the name of God. You have a piece of wood with God's name on it, you drill a hole in it, and you destroy it. He who does that should be put to death. Maybe that's what it means. The Talmud says. So the Talmud says, no, that's not possible. Why? Because you need to use two names, if you remember. The formula is that you must say the Creator is the source of the curse. He should be the one that curses, and then you must say also that he's the recipient of the curse. So that would be impossible. If you're just going to tell me that the violation is to drill a hole in this placard, in this piece of wood that has God's name on it, because how are you going to destroy this name with another name? You have to destroy it with a drill or with a knife or something. Okay? So the Talmud says, well, maybe it means that you take two names of God and you put one on top of the other and then you cut through with a knife. Okay? So it's like symbolically, like you're destroying. You have one name and you cut through that one name, then you cut through the second name to indicate, to symbolically portray the idea of one name destroying the other name. So the Talmud says, no, that's not really good because symbolic is not a halachic concept. Halacha always works in a physical way, in an actual physical way. And over here, all you're doing is just making a hole through one name, and then you're making a hole through the second name. But you... So now to Thomas Aquinas. Thomas says, well, maybe it means like this. Maybe you should take the name of God and then inscribe it on a, let's say, a piece of sharp metal, like a knife. And then you'll use that knife with one which has the name of God on it to cut the piece of wood, let's say, that has God's name on it. So you'll be destroying one name with the other name. So the Talmud says, no, that's no good either. Why? Because that which is destroying the piece of wood is not the name on the knife, it's the knife itself, the sharpness of the knife itself. So therefore, you're still not destroying one name with another name. All right? Okay. Now, that's really the end of that little piece of Talmud, where the Talmud removes the possibility of the word in the Torah, in that verse in the Torah, where the oral law zeroes in on, the halachic verse, that states precisely the formula of cursing, blaspheming the Creator. Now, that's the end of this little piece of Talmud. Now, of course, now we have a third problem, as I said, and we're going to answer all three. The third problem is, what kind of sense does that make? When we say that the person should write God's name, maybe the Torah means you're writing God's name down on a piece of wood, and then you'll drill it, or you'll cut it with a knife. Where did they get this idea from? Where did the Talmudists get this idea from? Where did that idea come from? Okay. So we have three questions. First was my question, that every curse always has as its source God. Second question was, how do we derive from the verse in Leviticus 24, how do we derive from those extra three words that you must curse the Creator with the using the name of the Creator? How do we get that? Okay? That's question two. Question three is, where did the Talmud come up with this concept of writing God's name down on a piece of paper, or actually it could be even a piece of paper, I just had a piece of wood and then just cutting it with a knife, okay? The answer is, there's one underlying idea over here. And once we grasp that underlying idea, you see how everything will fit in. The underlying idea is that cursing the Creator is not like an ordinary curse. The violation of cursing the Creator is really the diminution of His name. Okay? That's the concept that underlies this violation. The concept that underlies violation means in cursing and blasphemy, what you're doing is you're reducing, you're detracting, you're diminishing the name of God. That is the violation. Okay? Now, let's keep that concept in mind. Once you have that concept, now you'll see how all three questions are answered. It becomes immediately apparent as to why the Talmud offers the possibility of writing the name of God down on a piece of wood and then drilling it. Because that would also constitute a diminishing, a taking away, a sign of disrespect for the Creator. Okay? Now let's go back to the question of how they derive it. Let's take my question now. My question was, why did Talmud? What kind of a question is this? There's a formula for cursing, and a formula for cursing always involves the Creator as being the source. The answer is because blasphemy is not the same thing as cursing a human being. Blasphemy is any kind of, the concept of blasphemy is diminishing from the name of God. That's what the concept is. It's not like ordinarily. When you ordinarily curse somebody, that's a different idea altogether. That is not the same thing as blasphemy. That means you're not permitted to say that God should curse a certain human being. But in cursing the Creator, there's a different concept. The violation is not the curse itself. You see, it's the diminishing of the reverence for God's name. That's what it is. Therefore, the Talmud rightly asks how do we know that you have to have the creator involved in the curse itself? Maybe if the person just cursed the creator without having the creator's name as the source of this curse, that alone is enough diminution. Where do you see that you have to have the creator as being the one that should activate, that should actually perform the curse? Okay? Now the Talmud, now we understand the derivation also from the extra three words in the verse. You see, the Talmud says like this: one of the methods of deriving, as some of you may know, of deriving halacha from the Torah itself, or showing halacha from the Torah itself, is by the Torah's method of adding extra words. And over here, the addition of the extra words fits in just perfectly. What it means is as follows. The first part of the verse says, he who curses the name of God shall be put to death. Now, over here, we're just talking about diminishing from the name of God. But then it says, it repeats it again, when he curses... So, now we're back to the... we're back to the question. Hello? Yeah, we're back to the question of how do we derive from those extra three words the fact that the creator has to be the source as the one, the performer, as well as the object. And the answer is now very simple. What it means is like this. The idea of cursing is reducing the reverence, diminishing from God, from the name of God. That's the idea of cursing. When the Torah adds those three words, what it means to say is you must reduce the Creator in the highest possible way. In other words, when the Torah adds words, what it means is increase the quantity to the fullest. Now, since the Creator is the source of everything, so you have to use the Creator. If you wanted to take away from the Creator to the highest degree, you'd have to use Him as the source, because He is the Almighty, the most powerful being in existence. So you'd have to use the Creator Himself in order to do it in the worst possible way. In other words, you'd have to invoke the most powerful source in existence, which is God. So if you just said the curse, if you just said that Yossi, I'm using the word Yossi because now I have a blessing, if you just said that Yossi should be destroyed, that would not be the highest form of a curse, because you still haven't invoked the highest source for that destruction. The highest source for that destruction is the Creator Himself. So therefore, you must say Yossi, the source of all power, should destroy Yossi. Okay? Does everyone get that point? In other words, by adding those three words in the Torah, what the Torah is doing is the Torah is saying that this diminution of God's name must be accomplished with the highest, most powerful source in existence. So therefore, the only formula that's possible is that the Creator, in other words, the source of all existence, should be the source from which this destruction should take place. So therefore, you have to say Yossi should be destroyed, but Yossi should be destroyed by Yossi, by the greatest source. You'd have to have God would have to be used both times. Both as the one who initiates the process and as the one who is the recipient of the process. Because if you just said that Yossi should be destroyed, you're not saying by who. So you're not involving any source. And therefore, it would lack in the full concept of diminution. Because in order to complete, in order to make your diminution to the greatest degree possible, you must also invoke the greatest source possible, which is the Creator Himself. So therefore, logically, you'd have to use the Creator as the source of the harm that is being done, and also as the one who receives that harm as well. It must be from the greater source, and it must be, of course, to the Creator, which would have to be, which would necessitate using the name of God as the recipient of the, of course, if you don't use him as the object, then, of course, there's no curse to begin with. So, therefore, there are two components. That God, the person must use Yossi as being the recipient of the curse, and then the person must also say that this curse, or this damage, or this harm, or this destruction must be initiated by the greatest force in the universe. Therefore, he has to mention the Creator again. Okay, so therefore we see that the concept, but the underlying concept of this whole piece of Talmud is, gives us an insight into what is meant by a curse or by blasphemy. Blasphemy is the diminution of the name of God, and this diminution must be accomplished on the highest possible level, which would necessitate the involvement of the highest source and power of all powers, which is God himself. That's how the Talmud states. That's why you have that unique formula, that a person is not really called a blasphemer unless he uses the Creator in two frames. He must use him as the source of the harm and the destruction, and also as the recipient of the harm and the destruction. In other words, basically, he must say that Yossi should destroy himself. Yossi should destroy Yossi. If he just says that Yossi should be destroyed, of course, this person cannot be considered a righteous person. It's a violation. It's a terrible thing. But he still is not technically, he hasn't done it in the fullest manner which would make him deserving of the penalty of death. Okay? We have to, in other words, what the Talmud has to ascertain here is what is the exact formula which the Torah is speaking about, where the person is not simply saying something bad. A person could say many bad things, and he would not be considered a righteous person. Certainly not. He would be considered an evil person. But in order to be deserving of the death penalty, he must do it in a specific way, in the most horrible way, and that is to use the Creator both as the source and as the recipient of a curse, of a horrible thing, a destruction or a curse or whatever. Okay? That explains all three questions. It answers my question as well, because my question was, every curse always has God as the initiator, but every curse is not the same as blasphemy. Every curse is different. Every curse means that you aren't permitted to say that an individual is cursed by God. That's where you aren't distorting God. But over here, blasphemy is where you diminish the name of God, and the Talmud rightly raises the question, well, if a person just said that Yossi should be destroyed, that certainly is diminishing the name of God. But then the Talmud says, no, we see from the extra verse, from the extra phrase, that this extra phrase indicates that it must be done on the highest level in order to be deserving of the penalty of death, as that verse states. So therefore, you must have the Creator being the initiator and the Creator being the recipient. And the third question, of course, is also answered, why the Talmud says that if a person, that perhaps it means that a person takes the name of God, writes it on a piece of wood, and then drills it, that he takes a knife and cuts through it, that this would be considered also a violation, because since it's diminishing God's name, that would diminish from God's name as well. And there is a prohibition, of course, that a person is not permitted to erase the name of God. By the way, I one time had a question that came to me that someone wrote, God's name, one of the names of God, on a blackboard. A teacher happened to write it because that's why I mentioned last week that this area, very careful when you study areas like this, that you can get involved in violations without realizing it. What happened was the teacher wanted to demonstrate to the class, show the class what one of the names of God is in Exodus, where Moses asked God, when the children of Israel asked me, what is his name, what shall I say? And then God replies, Eki, I'm saying it, I'm changing it, because I can't say it the right way. Eki Asher Eki, I will be that which I will be. Okay? Now, that idea is an idea of God's existence. I will be that which I will be. So it's a deep concept, to understand it. It has to do with the fact that God's existence is changeless. Okay? So that is, according to many scholars, considered one of the names of God. So this teacher, who happened to be a very learned rabbi, but he was, you know, he was explaining this, and he just wrote it on the board. So it was brought to my attention, and I called Rabbi Feinstein, and I asked him the question, and he said, of course, you've got to take the blackboard and just put it away forever, because you're not permitted to erase that. What happened was, though, by the time we got back to the blackboard, some youngster didn't realize, he just erased it. But that is one of 613 negative violations of the Torah, that you're not permitted to erase the name of God. So because you're diminishing from the reverence for God. So that's why the Talmud raises that also as a valid possibility.
Rabbi.
Yes.
A point. We were at Bar-Ilan University last week.
Yes.
And Bar-Ilan has the entire Talmud on CD-ROM.
Right, that's true. I know. My son's trying to buy it, as a matter of fact.
All right, well, he needs to talk to me.
Oh, good. He'll be happy to hear that.
Because I was blown totally out of my socks with what I saw.
Really?
But now, see, one of the problems they had was how could they produce the Talmud and all the responders with the text of the Torah, which contains the Tetragrammaton.
Right.
And how could they do it and use it without violating this principle you just talked about?
That's correct.
So...
Not just the Tetragrammaton, actually the seven names of God.
Yeah, the
seven names.
Yes, that's correct. So how did they get around that?
Okay.
The answer is that on the computer generation, it's not written.
That's correct.
It's just generated letters.
That's right.
And so every time they push, when they turn they send it back to the files, they're not actually, writing the name, and they're not erasing the name.
That's
it's correct. Just a generation.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, another question was raised is, let's say someone has a tape recording of God's name.
Can you
erase that tape, re-tape over that?
We discussed that last week also.
That's correct. That is not considered the name of God. It must appear like a scribe would write it. Not the modern technology is not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I had an interesting question, which was the question was with regard to taking a picture of the sun of the sunset, because one of the things that you're not permitted to do is to draw a picture of the sun, and here of course my decision was that you're not permitted to do it, because even though when you take that picture, you snap a photo of the sun, so what happens in the camera is not halakhically considered, just like the case you mentioned, that's not halakhically considered as drawing, because you're simply activating the silver there. But if you open up the camera, as a matter of fact, you'll destroy everything, because the light will destroy everything. There is no real picture in there that is visible for the human eye. The only problem is, when you send it for developing, you're instructing the person to produce the picture, and there he is producing a picture. So that is somewhat of a problem. So you have to know exactly, you see, how to apply the in modern technology. Sometimes it's not considered a violation, but then another time you got to be careful, because sometimes it could really involve a violation. But getting back to this text of the Talmud, the important thing is, I think, if you go over this, is to see that when you take a look at a piece of Talmud, you must look for the underlying premise. And once you find that premise, it makes sense. If it doesn't make sense, it means you did not hit that premise. And over here, this premise is extremely important, because you see that the rabbis are having these discussions, but the discussions revolve around one underlying premise, that the concept of blasphemy is diminution of the name of God. It's not like cursing a person. That's a completely different phenomenon. That's where you're not taking away from God's reverence. But what you're doing is you're cursing a specific individual, and you must use God as the source, because that is the violation, to say that God should curse so and so. But over here, it's a different concept. Cursing God and cursing a human being are not to be put in the same category. cursing of God is diminution of the reverence for God. And that's why the, that's why these Talmudic questions really make sense. And once you see the underlying principle, you see what the, you see also the derivation from the extra words, the quantitative increase that it must be to the utmost degree. And also you see the why the Talmud raised the question about writing the name of God down on a piece of wood. Maybe that's the violation. Okay. So we've really finished this this small little piece. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to take them. If not, I will mention something else that's in this piece of Talmud, which I avoided because I want to keep a logical order and not get sidetracked. But I will take. I'm about to take up another piece that's right in this another principle, Talmudic principle that's right contained right here in this piece of Talmud. So if there are any questions, fine. If not, I'm going to continue.
Continue.
Okay. Now, the Talmud, in stating the law, it says like this. It says that, I don't know if you have that piece of Talmud in front of you in English. It would be a good idea, though. It states like this. It states, how do we know this? So we say, Samuel said, that's one of the Talmudic scholars, because the verse says, and if you curse the name of God, and then the Talmud says, well, how do we know that this term is means to curse, as we said before? So the Talmud says, well, we derive that from Balaam because he used the same expression, and over there it can only have one meaning. And then the Talmud says that the warning for this is from another verse, and that verse is in Exodus, and there it says it uses the word Elohim. Now, Elohim, I'm saying Kim, it really should be Him, but I can't pronounce that. So it's Elohim, I'm saying Elohim. Now, over there it says, Elohim lo sekala, which means God, you shall not curse. It also means you shall not curse a judge as well, by the way. But the Talmud says it's a reference to God as well. So that is a warning, the Talmud says. So in other words, the Talmudic statement is, where is the warning? There must be a warning in the Torah. Again, when the Talmud wanted to give as a possibility the idea of drilling a hole in a piece of wood that has God's name on it, it says the warning would be from Deuteronomy, where it says, "You shall not do so. You shall destroy the names of the that the idolaters write and scribe on their religious objects, and you should not do this to God, your God," which means you're not permitted to erase the name of God. So the Talmud says that would be the warning. In the event that we would interpret, if we should interpret the verse in Leviticus as meaning drilling a hole, well, we have to have a warning for that. So the Talmud says the warning would be from Deuteronomy. Okay. Now, in other words, the Talmud says there are two possibilities here. One is that it means to curse, and then the warning is from Exodus, where it says, "You shall not curse God." And use the word Elohim, which means a judge, but also means God. So that warning would be from there. Or you could say it means drill a hole, and the Talmud immediately says, and the warning will be from Deuteronomy. All right, now what is this warning business? When a person just looks at a piece of Talmud in English, not familiar with it, say, well, what are they talking about? What's the concept of a warning? Where does this come from? The concept is as follows. The concept is, that whenever the Torah gives a punishment, it always must have a warning also. It doesn't have to be before. As you see over here, the warning could be from Deuteronomy. But there must always be a warning. Let me just give you the most blatant example is in Leviticus. All right? In Leviticus, and it's something that you should be familiar with. It's in Leviticus, let's take 18, okay? So 18, take a look at 18, 6, all right? So here it's speaking about the sexual prohibitions. And now it says 18:6 gives a general principle that you should not have intercourse with anyone that's a close relative. And then it states in 7 that the... it states that the nakedness of your father and your mother you should not uncover, all right? And this means the by the father, it doesn't mean the father himself, it doesn't mean homosexuality. Over here it means the father's, this is, it means the wife of the father, even though it's not your mother. So in other words, there's a prohibition against living with someone who was the wife of his father. And also the second one is the mother. Now, take a look over. See, now this is in Leviticus 18:7, and it gives a whole list. It keeps on going. Or a whole list of all the people that one is not permitted to live with. Then you have in Leviticus, again later, you have a repetition of this law. Take a look. Leviticus 20:10. Twenty eleven. A man who will live with the wife of his father, he revealed the nakedness of his father, they should both be put to death. Okay? And it goes through the the violations. For instance, homosexuality is prohibited in 1822. But over there it just says you shall not live with a man the way one lives with a woman, and that is 18:22, and then it says anyone who does so will be put to death. That's 20:13. Okay, so and et cetera. In other words, it has in 18 it tells the prohibition without telling the punishment. And then in 20, it gives you the punishment. Now, why is the Torah repetitious? So the oral law explains to us that every case in the Torah where the Torah gives a punishment, there always must be a warning. And this is a principle. What is the reason for this principle? The reason for this principle is that the Torah is not a book of punishments. The Torah really is a book of morals and ethics. The book of God's system, God's law. And the punishments only result from the person doing an action through which he deteriorates his soul. The punishment is not just because God wishes to punish people. So that's why in the Torah, whenever we have a punishment, there always must be another statement, which is a warning. What does the warning show? The warning shows that this is an evil action. The person who does this, this action is evil. If the Torah would just say, and if a person lives with the wife of his father, he should be put to death, then it would...
Rabbi, we've got 1 minute.
Okay. Then it would imply that God wants this person put to death. That's it. He's capricious. No, the Torah first says you shouldn't do that. When the Torah says you should not do that, the Torah is saying that there is something in this which is wrong and evil. And then it states the punishment. But the Torah never just gives punishments, because then the Torah will be a book of punishments. That's not what it is. It's a book, really, of ethics and morals and perfection. Punishment is only there because in order to institute the system, this is necessary, but not as an end in itself. The end in itself is perfection. And that's why the Talmud states that that's the style of the Torah, that wherever you have a punishment, there always must be some place in the Torah where it also gives a warning, where it shows that this is an imperfection, not just simply a statement of punishment alone. A statement of punishment alone will not do. Okay, we will stop over here.